Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, February 12, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. Former President Donald Trump's lawyer is mounting a defense in the Senate impeachment trial, saying that he is not guilty of inciting insurrection in the attack on the Capitol January 6th, arguing he specifically urged peaceful protest and the rioters themselves that day are to blame. And that his use of the words like fight like hell was metaphorical, similar to what a lot of politicians use, and protected by the First Amendment. Former president's lawyer is also saying the House impeachment managers are pursuing political vengeance. The impeachment trial also moving on to the question and answer period from senators, final arguments, and a final vote expected on Saturday. Also today, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention putting out guidance for reopening schools for in-person learning using a color-coded zone system, basing it on the rate of coronavirus transmission in the community. President Joe Biden meets with governors and mayors at the White House, both Republicans and Democrats, on the coronavirus economic aid bill being put together in Congress. And Deputy White House Press Secretary T.J. Ducklow suspended for a week without pay, following a report that he threatened to destroy a reporter who was writing a story about his relationship with another reporter. Now to the impeachment trial in the Senate. This from the Associated Press. Lawyers for Donald Trump defended him against impeachment Friday by accusing Democrats of waging a campaign of hatred against the former president and manipulating his words in the lead-up to the deadly siege of the U.S. Capitol. First to speak was attorney Michael Vanderveen.
The article of impeachment now before the Senate is an unjust and blatantly unconstitutional act of political vengeance. This appalling abuse of the Constitution only further divides our nation when we should be trying to come together around shared priorities. Like every other politically motivated witch hunt the left has engaged in over the past 4 years, this impeachment is completely divorced from the facts, the evidence, and the interests of the American people. The Senate should promptly and decisively vote to reject it. No thinking person could seriously believe that the president's January 6th speech on the Ellipse was in any way an incitement to violence or insurrection. The suggestion is patently absurd on its face. Nothing in the text could ever be construed as encouraging, condoning, or enticing unlawful activity of any kind.
Michael Vanderveen. More from the Associated Press article on the presentation from the attorneys for the former president. AP writes, they sought to reduce the case to Trump's use of a single word, fight, in a speech preceding the January 6th riot. They played dozens of clips showing Democrats, some of them senators now serving as jurors, using the same word to energize supporters in speeches railing against Trump. Again, here is attorney Michael Vanderveen.
This sham impeachment also poses a serious threat to freedom of speech for political leaders of both parties at every level of government. The Senate should be extremely careful about the precedent this case will set. Consider the language that the House impeachment article alleges to constitute incitement. If you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. This is ordinary political rhetoric that is virtually indistinguishable from the language that has been used by people across the political spectrum for hundreds of years. Countless politicians have spoken of fighting for our principles. Joe Biden's campaign slogan was "Battle for the Soul of America." No human being seriously believes that the use of such metaphorical terminology is incitement to political violence.
Attorney Michael Vanderveen. Another of the former president's lawyers today, David Schoen, told the senators there is significant reason to doubt the evidence of the House managers Let me say this clearly. We have reason to believe the House managers manipulated evidence and selectively edited footage. If they did, and this were a court of law, they would face sanctions from the judge. David Schoen pointing the House impeachment managers' use of never-before-seen video earlier this week as evidence that Donald Trump is not getting a fair trial.
On Wednesday this week, countless news outlets repeated the Democrat talking point about the power of never-before-seen footage. Let me ask you this. Why was this footage never seen before? Shouldn't the subject of an impeachment trial, this impeachment trial, President Trump, have the right to see the so-called new evidence against him? More importantly, the riot and the attack on this very building was a major event that shocked and impacted all Americans. Shouldn't the American people have seen this footage as soon as it was available? For what possible reason did the House managers withhold it from the American people and President Trump's lawyers? For political gain? How did they get it? How were they the ones releasing it? It is evidence in hundreds of pending criminal cases against the rioters. Why was it not released through law enforcement or the Department of Justice? Is it the result of a rushed snap impeachment for political gain without due process? House Manager Raskin told us all yesterday that your job as jurors in this case is a fact-intensive job. But of course, as several of the House managers have told you, we still don't have the facts. Speaker Pelosi herself on February 2nd called for a 9/11 style commission to investigate the events of January 6th. Speaker Pelosi says that the commission is needed to determine the causes of the events. She says it herself. If an inquiry of that magnitude is needed to determine the causes of the riot, and it may very well be, then how can these same Democrats have the certainty needed to bring articles of impeachment and blame the riots on President Trump? They don't. The House managers, facing a significant lack of evidence, turned often to press reports and rumors during these proceedings. Claims that would never meet the evidentiary standards of any court.
David Schoen, one of the attorneys for Donald Trump on the Senate floor during the impeachment trial this Friday. His team of attorneys also arguing today that a former president cannot be impeached under the Constitution and that the Democrats only want to prevent Donald Trump from running for president again in 2024 because they fear him as an electoral opponent. And there was also this from attorney Bruce Castor, who says the timeline from House impeachment managers just doesn't add up.
President Trump's words couldn't have incited the riot at the Capitol. The day's events make this clear. Let's walk through the actual timeline. At 11:15 a.m., police security camera video show crowds forming at First Street near the Capitol reflecting pool. This is a full 45 minutes before President Trump even took the stage on January 6th. Let me repeat that. Violent criminals were assembling at the Capitol over a mile away almost an hour before the president uttered a single word on the ellipse. You did not hear that fact during the hours and hours of the House manager's presentation, did you? When the president spoke, what did he call for? He called for rally attendees to peacefully and patriotically make their voices heard, for them to walk down Pennsylvania Avenue to cheer on members of Congress. President Trump went on for more than an hour, ending at 1:11. Now, why is this important? Because of all of the events that I am about to describe, they all occurred before President Trump's remarks concluded. At 12:49 p.m., the first barriers at the U.S. Capitol grounds were pushed over and the crowd entered the restricted area. At 11:05 p.m., Acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller received open source reports of demonstrator movements to the U.S. Capitol. At 1:09 p.m., U.S. Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund called the House and Senate sergeants at arms, telling them he wanted an emergency declared, and he wanted the National Guard called. The point? Given the timeline of events, the criminals at the Capitol weren't there at the Ellipse to even hear the president's words. They were more than a mile away, engaged in their pre-planned assault on this very building. This was a pre-planned assault, make no mistake, and that is a critical fact.
Attorney Bruce Castor on the Senate floor. In all, the legal team for former President Donald Trump using just a few hours to make their case, a fraction of the 16 hours they had available if they wanted it. The next step in the process was the senators asking questions. They did so in writing on specially designated cards, which were passed up to the presiding officer, Senator Patrick Leahy, who is the Senate President Pro Tem. Here's one of the questions from Republican Senators Mitt Romney and Susan Collins. You're going to hear answers from the House Impeachment Manager Joaquin Castro and Attorney for the President Michael Vanderveen. First, though, the question read by the Senate clerk.
When President Trump sent the disparaging tweet at 2:24 p.m. regarding Vice President Pence, was he aware that the Vice President had been removed from the Senate by the Secret Service for his safety?
The House of Representatives, managers are recognized 2.5 minutes.
Thank you. Well, let me tell you what he said at 2:24 p.m. He said Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution. The USA demands the truth. And you know by now what was all over the media. You couldn't turn on the television, couldn't turn on the radio, couldn't consume any media, or probably take any phone calls or anything else without hearing about this, and also hearing about the Vice President. And here's what Donald Trump had to know at that time, because the whole world knew it, all of us knew it. Live television had, by this point, shown that the insurgents were already inside the building and that they had weapons and that the police were outnumbered. And here are the facts that are not in dispute. Donald Trump had not taken any measures to send help to the overwhelmed Capitol Police. As president, at that point, when you see all this going on and the people around you are imploring you to do something and your vice president is there, why wouldn't you do it? Donald Trump had not publicly condemned the attack. The attackers had told him to stand down despite multiple pleas to do so. And Donald Trump hadn't even acknowledged the attack. And after Wednesday's trial portion concluded, Senator Tuberville spoke to reporters and confirmed the call that he had with the president and did not dispute Manager Cicilline's description in any way that there was a call between he and the president around the time that Mike Pence was being ushered out of the chamber. And that was shortly after 2 p.m. And Senator Tuberville specifically said that he told the president, "Mr. President, they just took the vice president out. I've got to go." That was shortly after 2 p.m. There were still hours of chaos and carnage and mayhem. The vice president and his family were still in danger at that point. Our commander-in-chief did nothing.
Counsel for the former president?
The answer is no. At no point was the president informed the vice president was in any danger, because the House rushed through this impeachment in 7 days with no evidence. There is nothing at all in the record on this point, because the House failed to do even a minimum amount of due diligence. What the president did know is that there was a violent riot happening at the Capitol. That's why he repeatedly called via tweet and via video for the riots to stop, to be peaceful, to respect Capitol Police and law enforcement, and to commit no violence and to go home. But to be clear, this is an article of impeachment for incitement. This is not an article of impeachment for anything else. It's a one count. They could have charged anything they wanted. They chose to charge incitement. So that the question, although answered directly no, it's not really relevant to the charges for the impeachment in this case. And I just wanted to clear up one more thing. Mr. Castro, in his first answer, may have spoke, but what he said was Mr. Trump had said, fight to the death. That's false. I'm hoping he misspoke. Thank you.
Michael Van Der Veen, attorney for former President Trump. You also heard from House Impeachment Manager Congressman Joaquin Castro. And one question out of 28 asked by senators during the Q&A period portion of the Senate impeachment trial. Took about 2.5 hours. They did have up to 4 hours to use to ask questions had they wanted. So the Senate is back on Saturday at 10 a.m. Eastern for final arguments, again up to 4 hours, and then a final vote. A two-thirds vote, 67 senators required for a conviction of an impeachment under the Constitution. It's not expected to happen in this case, but there's this from Politico. 6 GOP senators voted this week to move forward with President Donald Trump's impeachment trial, but Republicans believe several more of them may be considering conviction. As the Trump defense made its argument on Friday, Republicans privately estimated between 5 and 10 of the senators are seriously weighing conviction. There's no official whip count, and the matter is not being discussed at party meetings, leaving many in the 50-member conference to only guess at their colleagues' inclinations. You can read more at Politico.com. And Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. The Biden administration says the first batch of asylum seekers waiting in Mexico for their next immigration court hearings to be allowed back into the U.S. while the cases are proceeding will start on February 19th. 3 border crossings will process a few hundred people each per day. There are about 25,000 asylum seekers in Mexico with active cases. And President Biden plans to close the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, by the end of this term. Closing Gitmo was also a priority for former President Barack Obama, and he did not get that done. This from the Washington Post. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said Friday that schools can safely open as long as a range of precautions are in place, offering a roadmap for return to classrooms that in parts of the country have been shuttered for nearly a year. When infection rates in the community are higher, the agency recommends shifting to a combination of in-person and remote learning to minimize the number of people in school buildings at any given time. Fully remote learning is recommended only in certain cases when virus rates are very high. The CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, spoke to reporters today by telephone.
CDC is releasing an operational strategy for K-12 schools through phased mitigation that provides a pathway to support schools in opening for in-person instruction and remaining open. This science-based strategy recommends an integrated package of tools that supports safe school reopening and protects teachers, students, and school staff. One of the most pivotal components of this strategy is layered mitigation, recognizing that all mitigation strategies provide some level of protection, but when implemented together or layered, they provide the greatest level of protection. CDC specifically recommends 5 key layered mitigation strategies: universal and correct use of masks, physical distancing, hand washing and respiratory etiquette, cleaning and maintaining healthy facilities, and diagnostic and rapid and efficient contact tracing in combination with isolation and quarantine and in collaboration with the health department. While each of these 5 strategies is important to prevent and reduce the spread of COVID-19 and to support safe school reopening, CDC recommends prioritizing the first 2, universal and correct use of masks that should be required for all students, teachers, and staff, and physical distancing of at least 6 feet between people with cohorting or podding of students to minimize exposure across the school environment. These 2 strategies are incredibly important in areas that have high community spread of COVID-19, which right now is the vast majority of communities in the United States. We know that most clusters in the school setting have occurred when there are breaches in mask wearing.
CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky on a teleconference. The guidance today includes a color-coded chart dividing schools' reopening options into four zones. There's blue, yellow, orange, and red, ranging from low to high community spread of the coronavirus, and correspondingly, the recommendations ranging from in-person learning to remote schooling or a hybrid. Daily new coronavirus cases in the U.S. now back over 100,000. That happened on Thursday. This after the cases fell below that level for the first time in months earlier this week. Overall trends, though, in recent weeks still positive, cases and hospitalizations falling from the January highs. Still about 3,000 people in the U.S. dying every day from COVID-19. At the White House, President Biden meeting with governors and mayors of both parties on the coronavirus economic relief bill that he has submitted to Congress, $1.9 trillion total, $350 billion of that is aid to states and local governments.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for coming in to talk about the COVID plans we put forward and their needs and their ideas and their recommendations of how to proceed. And the American Rescue Plan has multiple pieces. The most important piece, in my view, is making sure we give them enough capacity to deal with the virus in their states and how we're going to do that. But equally consequential is the need to help the states economically in terms of everything from unemployment to being able to make sure that they're able to get kids back in schools and what role the federal government should play in helping getting that done. And, these folks are all on the front lines. They've been dealing with this crisis from day one. I'm not making a political statement. It's taken a while to adjust. They've been left on their own in many cases. I think some have found what I found when I got here that we thought was available in terms of everything from vaccine to vaccinators was not the case. So I thank them for the work they did in their cities and their states in order to respond to the crisis. But I think it's, and I've said it plainly while I was running and as president, that I think the federal government has a major role to play here. But these are the folks that are on the ground dealing with it every single solitary day. And they see the pain and they see the successes when they occur. And what I really want to know about is what should that the recovery plan, should we have more or less of anything in it? What do they think they need most? How to proceed? Because as I've said before, governors and mayors, that's a real job. I was a senator for years. I got in a train every day and came to Washington, D.C., and I'd get asked questions by the conductors and the shoeshine guys and the ticket masters, but every single day, these folks are home. Every single day, they're meeting with their constituents. We're down here in Washington, and we meet with them. I don't mean to belittle it at all, but it's not the same as being on the ground. And so whenever I want to know what's really happening, I want to talk, and I'm not being solicitous, to governors and mayors. And so thank you for being here, and that's what we're going to be doing today. Thank you all.
President Joe Biden in the White House Oval Office. After that meeting, one of the participants, Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, a Republican, spoke with reporters in the White House driveway.
Does the president indicate to you what the figure will be for states and local? Does it seem like it's going to shrink from his initial $350 billion?
I'll let him comment on that. I mean, he submitted his plan with a specific figure. I think it's $350 billion in there.
But did he set new expectations that it would probably be lower?
He did not waver from that. I did urge him that because of the varying needs in the states, that compromise is appropriate. That's too high, $1.6 trillion, $1.9 trillion. That's too high. It needs to be lower, needs to be compromise reached so that we can bring bipartisan support.
Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson in the White House driveway. Another Republican who was at that meeting in the Oval Office with the president, the mayor of Miami, Frances Suarez, who joined the White House press secretary for her daily briefing and took a reporter's question.
I was hoping you could answer the complaint, the criticism we've heard from Republicans of late. It's been that states and cities
have received several rounds of funding so far that they haven't spent, so why do they need billions more from the taxpayers now? So what would be your response to that?
Well, my response as a Republican mayor is, first of all, for cities like Miami, we actually didn't get a lot of the money from the first CARES Act. As I said, since we were under 500,000, by the way, almost all cities were under 500,000. I think there's only 30-something cities that got direct payments. Many of them had very, very bad experiences in terms of receiving the full allotment that they should have received based on their population. It was a big fight down in Miami. So our residents got a fraction of the help that they needed. In terms of the budgetary, you know, issues going forward, we just don't know. It's uncertain as to what our budget's going to look like in this year. A lot of the things that affect local governments are lagging indicators. So we won't know for sure. But certainly, we're going to put the money to good use, and I think we've demonstrated that with the funding that we did receive under the first CARES Act.
Miami Mayor Francis Suarez at the White House. Pentagon announcing today that 20 more teams of active duty military personnel are being mobilized to help coronavirus vaccination efforts around the country. That brings the total so far from the Pentagon to 4,700 troops out of 10,000 requested by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 27, NASDAQ up 69, S&P up 18. A new poll from Gallup says 56% of the U.S. workforce is continuing to work remotely all the time or part-time due to the coronavirus pandemic. That's down just 2 percentage points from 4 months ago. The high point was 70%, and that was last April. A deputy White House press secretary, T.J. Ducklow, has been suspended for a week without pay after a Vanity Fair story said that Ducklow threatened a reporter from Politico who was working on a story about his romantic relationship with another reporter from Axios that had covered the Biden campaign. Specifically, Ducklow threatened the reporter, vowing he would destroy her if she published the story, Ducklow also making misogynistic comments to that reporter. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki addressed this today.
President on Inauguration Day spoke to people that he was, I guess swearing at, new staff. And he said, "I promise I will fire you on the spot, no ifs, ands, or buts, if they speak down to or disrespect their colleagues." Now, it's not a colleague being questioned here, but isn't this sort of well short what he pledged on Inauguration Day?
As I've said, Josh, it doesn't meet our standard. It doesn't meet the president's standard. And it was important that we took a step to make that clear. And that included not just an apology directly from him and apologies directly from us at the highest levels there, but also a step to suspend him for 1 week without pay. And that, in our view, was an important step to send the message that we don't find it acceptable.
Was the president involved in this discussion at all?
No, I have not discussed it with the president. It was a decision I made and with the approval of the chief of staff.
If you knew about this conversation for weeks, why wasn't TJ suspended until after the article dropped? He was here up until last night.
You're right. There were conversations that occurred with the reporter as well as editors at Politico immediately after the conversation occurred. That was how we engaged in a private manner. And that was what we felt was appropriate at the time.
The White House press secretary, Jen Psaki, during her regular daily briefing. Sunday is Valentine's Day. And First Lady Jill Biden on Thursday night installed on the White House lawn oversized pink, red, and white hearts, modeled after the candy conversation hearts. The hearts on the White House lawn inscribed with messages including strength, love, kindness, family, and healing. Jill Biden and President Biden looked at them Friday morning while walking their dogs.
What's your gift for Valentine's Day?
Oh, it's not Valentine's Day. I'm not telling you. Valentine's Day is a big day. Jill's favorite day. For real.
What inspired you to do this?
I just wanted some, joy, and I think things have been, so with the pandemic, just everybody's feeling a little down, so it's just a little joy, a little hope. That's all.
First year we were vice president. all you guys in the press walked out of the executive office building. I walked into my office, and every single pane, the vice president's office, you see those panes? There were 18 panes in each window. She had taken her the school kind of paint the kids put on poster boards, put a heart and said, Joe loves Jill. None of them said Jill loves Joe, but it was Joe loves Jill. And everyone. And I went on the next morning. Remember Juju Chang?
I do.
I did an interview with her. She said, I understand that you and your wife have a great love affair. And I said, I hope so. And I said, but everybody knows I love her more than she loves me. And she said, look me straight in the eye. I said, that's what everybody says.
President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden on the White House lawn Friday morning with the dogs Champ and Major, the German Shepherds. Jill Biden's office saying in a statement about those that artwork, the hearts on the lawn modeled after conversation hearts, the candy. They wrote, as you may know, the First Lady is known for her sense of humor, love of surprises, and celebrating traditions, especially with her family. Valentine's Day has always been one of her favorite holidays. Thanks for joining us on Washington Today. It's available as a podcast. Subscribe so you never miss one. And get the free C-SPAN Radio app to listen wherever you are. Hope you have a good night and weekend.